This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, March 28th, 2014. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Closing the Gap. It's a cliche, but it seems to be true. There's a huge gap between soldiers coming back from a war and the civilians who stayed at home. The soldiers have experienced things that won't necessarily resonate with people who haven't been there. This is not just a human problem, it's also a literary problem. If you're a poet who fought in a war, how do you write in a way that brings your civilian readers into that experience? Yusuf Komunyakaa shows us one way to do it in his poem Facing It. The poem is the subject of one of our core learning poems in the Learning Lab section of the Poetry Foundation's website. The Learning Lab is specifically designed for teachers, but the essays that accompany each poem are for everyone. The poem guide for Facing It is written by Robin Ekus, a poet who lives in San Francisco. She joins us from KQED. Robin, tell us a little bit about Yusuf Komunyakaa. I know that he served in Vietnam, but I don't know exactly what he did there.
Yeah, he was actually a correspondent and a managing editor for the military newspaper Southern Cross. So he was there to be a kind of dispassionate observer and reporter, which, of course, is a very different role than being a poet, which requires much more personal engagement.
Yeah, but he saw combat there, even if he didn't shoot a weapon himself, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about this poem that we're going to talk about today is that he came back from his tour of duty in the field. He'd witnessed combat and he'd reported about it, but he didn't really begin to write poems about Vietnam until about 14 years after he'd returned home. So for him, that gap you're talking about is a literal one as well as a figurative one.
Mm-hmm. So this poem, Facing It, is not directly about the war. It's about a visit to the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. Now, for listeners who haven't visited the Memorial Wall, can you describe it?
Sure. It's an expanse of black granite, almost like the world's longest tombstone, you might argue. It's a bit of a rift in the earth, hidden, I think, from view until you come upon it. And it was designed by Maya Lin, who was a young architecture student. She was actually 21 at the time when she created this monument, and she had responded to an open competition for the Vietnam Memorial to be erected in Washington. And so she had submitted this design, and she beat 1,420 other people in winning the commission. And for her, this site was about this kind of grassy site that was contained by these walls. And on the walls, on the black granite itself, are carved the names of the missing and dead. And so it's an extremely sobering experience to see it and to have the sheer acknowledgement of the numbers of people who were killed. You know, it's a new kind of monument for a new kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the men erecting the American flag at Iwo Jima, or it wasn't a soldier on horseback riding valiantly into battle. It was a very, very dark, stark, and sober view of the loss of these lives.
Yeah, it's one of the great works of public art in our lifetimes, I think. Now, when we interviewed Komunyakaa about the poem, which is part of our poetry tour of Washington, D.C., by the way, he said that the purpose of the memorial and all memorials is to provide a place for reflection.
And with the Vietnam monument, it is an active kind of reflection. The stone catches the light, shatters, moments that surprise us. It seems to be almost in motion at times.
The idea of reflection, I think this is the wonderful thing about poetry, is that it can be both literal and figurative in a way that sculpture also can be. When he's looking at that wall as a place of reflection, it's also just a literal reflection.
Yeah.
That you're standing there, you're looking at the mirrored, polished face of this stone, which is a blank slate for someone's personal reflection, I think.
Mm-hmm. So let's hear it, and then we'll go through it more slowly afterwards. Here's Yusuf Komunyakaa reading Facing It.
My black face fades, hiding inside the black granite. I said it wouldn't, damn it. No tears. I'm stone. I'm flesh. My clouded reflection eyes me like a bird of prey. The profile of night slanted against morning. I turn this way. The stone lets me go. I turn that way. I'm inside the Vietnam Veterans Memorial again, depending on the light to make a difference. I go down to 58,000 22 names, half expecting to find my own, and letters like smoke. I touch the name Andrew Johnson. I see the booby trap's white flash. Name shimmer on a woman's blouse, but when she walks away, the name still on the wall. Breaststrokes flash, a red bird's wings cutting across my stare, the sky, a plane in the sky. A white vet's image floats closer to me. Then his pale eyes look through mine. I'm a wonder. He's lost his right arm inside the stone. In the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair.
Now, Robin, I've heard this recording many times now, and it never fails to move me. It's really quite something. Let's go back over it. Let's go to the first lines when the poet is first standing right in front of the wall.
My black face fades, hiding inside the black granite.
So right away, he introduces race into the poem. It's not my face fades, which is probably what a white poet would have written, but my black face. Why does he do that?
Yeah, I mean, he's acknowledging the place of race, I think, in bearing witness to the war's casualties here. Mm. And it's also sort of an introduction of the residual anger, I think, that he has. You know, he just come from a place in which civil rights are just coming to the forefront.
Yeah, he's from Louisiana.
He's from Louisiana. And so it's impossible to not see those things in the blackness of the granite itself.
Mm-hmm. And then his reflected face fades, hiding inside the black granite. It's as if this is a confrontation that the poet would rather avoid.
Yeah. I think that's really true. And, you know, so much of this poem, I think when, as you said, you know, listening to him read it, it's so incredibly moving. It's so stark. It's as stark as the memorial itself.
Mm.
You can feel the poet in his language struggling to keep his feelings in check.
I said it wouldn't. Damn it. No tears. I'm stone. I'm flesh.
He's trying desperately to decide what he is. Is he a monument, or is he a living legacy? You can't help but see yourself in it and apart from it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just acknowledging that dichotomy of being there and then of not being a name on the wall, standing there to be alive, to have survived that, and yet to have such a close tie to those who did not.
And then begins a rather odd encounter with his own reflection.
My clouded reflection eyes me like a bird of prey. The profile of night slanted against morning. I turn this way. The stone lets me go. I turn that way. I'm inside the Vietnam Veterans Memorial again, depending on the light to make a difference.
What does he mean literally and figuratively by depending on the light to make a difference?
Yeah, it's a really curious phrase. I think what he means is that he's kind of struggling with his restlessness and hesitation here. He literally turns one way and his reflection no longer appears on the stone, or he can't see it. He turns a different way and he's back there. And so from a literal sense, the light itself makes a difference in placing his reflection on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
In a larger sense, in a more figurative sense, I think depending on the light to make a difference, to me, maybe that's a matter of the distance of time, the perspective we've gained. That's the light. And he's depending on that light to make some sort of difference, maybe in his emotional state, maybe in the legacy of these lost lives and in the sort of cultural impact this war had on our country. And I don't know that depending on the light to make a difference is an affirmative thing. I don't know that the light actually does make a difference. It's a wish, it's a hope, but I'm not sure that it does.
I go down to 58,022 names, half expecting to find my own, and letters like smoke. I touch the name Andrew Johnson. I see the booby trap's white flash.
Robin, one of the things that makes the Vietnam Memorial Wall so moving is that you see people looking for the names of their dead, the people that they knew. They've come to see it. It has this very personal feeling about it. This very abstract monument is not an abstraction at all to them.
Absolutely.
And here we find the poet finding and touching the name of Andrew Johnson. Was Johnson somebody that Komunyakaa knew?
I'm not entirely sure whether he knew him. I'm assuming that he did. He was a soldier from Kumanyika's hometown of Bogalusa, Louisiana. Mm. So he definitely represents a connection to his personal story. You know, what's also interesting is, ironically or not, Johnson is also the 17th U.S. president, not this particular Andrew Johnson, but the name, he shares the name with the guy who succeeded Lincoln. And he was also the president who denied freed slaves equal protection under the law in 1866. So it took 100 years later for African Americans to achieve that equal protection. And I don't think it is without great respect and acknowledgement that he is using that name there, that it has kind of a dual resonance.
Name shimmer on a woman's blouse, but when she walks away, the name still on the wall. Breaststrokes flash, a redbird's wings cutting across my stare, the sky, a plane in the sky.
In so many ways, that passage transports you not just to the day that he's standing there and the experience of seeing the bird passing over his shoulder or cutting across his stare or the plane that's in that sky, but I think it echoes the planes that were in the skies of Vietnam overhead when he was at war.
Yeah, there's something ominous about that plane, isn't there?
Yes, I think so. And, you know, it's also, it's very difficult, I think, for us in our context to see a plane in the sky in a poem and not think of other wars and other planes.
A white vet's image floats closer to me. Then his pale eyes look through mine. I'm a wonder. He's lost his right arm inside the stone.
So what's happening here? The poet's eyes meet the eyes of the white vet in the reflected stone. And what does he mean by, I'm a window?
I think he means that in again, a literal and a figurative way. He becomes a window through which that vet can see the past and the present, right? So when he's talking about the vet's pale eyes, he's kind of dissolving. That vet is dissolving. And so is Kumanyika. He's no longer stone. He's no longer flesh. He's kind of a glass, a looking glass through which someone else can see their own experience. And I think through which he sees his experience. You know, what's really interesting to me about that passage is when he writes, he's lost his right arm inside the stone. Mm-hmm. It's unclear to me whether that's merely a trick of the light, or if that vet has lost his arm during the war. So the ambiguity of these images and the ways in which they play and are about mirrored reflection kind of leave so much open to interpretation and so much open to contemplation. It's one of the strengths, I think, of the poem.
And what do you make of, he highlights that it's not just a vet, it's a white vet. And just at the beginning of the poem, he identified himself as a black man. Where are we in the poem racially at this point?
He is very conscious of that vet being white, that his pale eyes are looking through Kumanyika's, and that he's a window. And, you know, a window is something that you look through. You don't see the window. You see what's through the window. And I think in some ways it's a condemnation, and in other ways it's ambivalent. You know, he's just observing it. He's not necessarily questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that the image floats closer to his, and then his pale eyes look through mine. But we're not entirely clear what it is he sees.
And there's no racial resolution happening here. There's not some sense of the black vet and the white vet coming to this place of memory and burying the hatchet, as it were.
No, I think much more so it's about them standing side by side or layered on top of each other and having to face their own individual fears and recollections and poignances and understandings of what has occurred and what has taken place for them.
In the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair.
That's a very daring way to end a poem, kind of on a misperception. The poet at first thinks a woman is trying to erase the names when she's really just brushing her child's hair. What do you make of this ending? Is he saying it's all in his mind, what's happening here?
No, I wouldn't say that, but I would say, I mean, I really think this is one of the single greatest endings of a contemporary poem in the sense that it is a misperception, but it's one that is so loaded with this kind of futile attempt to remake the past, right? In the Black Mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. He's making the assumption that she's trying to reclaim the past or she's trying to prevent that death in some symbolic way. But then he has to change his mind and ultimately see that act for what it really is, which is this kind of incredibly tender gesture. She's brushing a boy's hair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's beautiful. It's her son. And that kind of attempt to connect with this impersonal piece of stone, right, in a very personal way. There's nothing more personal than that kind of tender gesture. And also the way in which he kind of takes a position of self-recrimination here. You know, as earlier in the poem, you know, he says, "Damn it, I said I wouldn't, damn it, no tears, I'm stone, I'm flesh." But in this way, he kind of backs away from that really stolid position. He says, no, she's brushing a boy's hair. He must make that acknowledgement. He must understand that there's love in the grief that is expressed in this place.
Robin Ekus, thanks so much.
Thank you, Curtis.
Robin Ekus's poem guide can be found on our website, along with dozens of other poem guides by a wide variety of writers. You can also read some of Robin's poetry on the site. She's the author of the poetry collection, The Mansion of Happiness. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.